are listening to Good Morning Atlanta, and I hope that you have started off the morning in the right way. I certainly have been having a great morning, aside from the fact that I almost got trapped in the elevator shaft on my way into the studio, which was a slightly harrowing moment, but no worries. I recovered my composure, and I waltzed right into the studio to meet with my guest for this morning, who is Kevin Hanville. And Kevin is here to talk to us about small business and small business growth. He is a business coach and expert. Kevin is actually the founder and CEO of Quadrant Group, which is a consulting firm that offers business transformation services across the country, focusing on increasing sales and profits and training business owners to become more effective leaders. Kevin's the author of this great book called Change or Go Broke. I read through it last night and took away a lot of good lessons. He has a lot of advice that you will not hear in other places, and that's why I thought he'd be an interesting person to bring into the studio today for our morning show. So, Kevin, welcome to Good Morning Atlanta.
Well, thank you.
And hopefully you made it here unscathed without any incidences in the elevator shaft.
Just the 85 traffic coming down.
So that is part of Atlanta. You are up in the burbs,
yep,
right, as we call them. So it is quite a trek here into the city. And we talk a lot about the city of Atlanta on the show and the way that we've evolved from a development standpoint. Obviously, a lot of people actually call it an unplanned city.
Very much so.
So, sort of like, surprise, this is going to be a really successful big city, and we didn't really plan for that. So, one of the downsides of that is our traffic. But you tried out the express lane.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that, the express lane either, but traffic was backed up so bad, I had the privilege of paying $5 to come down the HOV lane.
Sometimes it's worth it.
Yeah,
well,
this morning. Absolutely.
Right, I mean, I have been in several instances where I'm like, yeah, it's definitely worth it to pay the extra price.
It was actually backed up a couple places in the HOV lane.
So, I mean, that is capitalism at work, right? Some people are going to be willing to pay money for the privilege of arriving somewhere a little bit faster.
Yeah, normally I don't do that, but just wanted to make sure I was going to be here on time. So I said, yeah, I'll fork over the $5. And
well, I appreciate it. Otherwise, I'd just be rambling on about my harrowing elevator shaft incident. No, we're glad you're here. And why don't you give a little bit of background on how you got started as a business coach and the types of businesses that you work with and have gotten to know? I mean, you've consulted for hundreds of businesses at this point. So you've gotten to see a lot of the good and the bad and the ugly.
Absolutely.
And the cause and effect of why it turns out that way. How'd you get started?
Well, I was in corporate America. I was a sales rep and, you know, did the typical career climb of sales rep, national manager, VP of sales in the software industry. And about 2004, 2003, I got burnt out on corporate America and went and purchased a business coaching franchise. And came out of the block really quick, was the North American Rookie of the Year for the franchise and the Georgia Coach of the Year. And so I've been doing this. I bought my contract out about 4 years into a five-year contract. And so I've been business consulting and coaching now since 2004.
What types of companies do you consult for?
Across the board. Currently, I've got home health care clients. I've got a commercial locksmith. I've done sports marketing consulting across the spectrum.
So one of the things that I highlighted here in your book was when you said, the number one reason I have found for failure is the inability for business owners to get out of their own way.
Right.
And I thought that was funny because most of the times when people aren't achieving their goals or aren't getting where they want to go, they're looking externally at it's the this, it's that person, it's the marketplace, it's the economy, that kind of thing. So you really force people to take a look in the mirror and see what's going on with them personally. Why do you think that who the person is and, you know, how that person is operating has such an impact on how the business results turn out.
Well, a good example is in the book. At a fellow coach was coaching a restaurant, and he couldn't, the owner of the restaurant couldn't keep employees. And it turned out his management style during the heavy rushes was to scream and yell at everybody. And he didn't realize that his personality and his management style was the one driving the employees away, and he was constantly just blaming on, I just can't find good employees. And what I see more often than not when I'm working with business owners is all-powerful ego gets in the way. So they think they can double down. If I'm not, you know, I'm working 60 hours, maybe if I work 20 more hours a week or 40 more hours a week, I can pull this thing out. And it's just a combination of probably hubris and pride, and it takes it's a real leadership lesson for somebody to step back and say, okay, I actually need some help. And, you know, the old saying about insanity is doing the same thing over and over again expecting a different result. Small business owners are, well, even in corporate America, you know, that's a pretty classic axiom of what goes on. And the problem is, prior to the 2008 meltdown, we were, we're all living in a debt-fueled buying binge. And so you could be a mediocre or not very good business person and succeed because there was so much business. And what this meltdown has done is really culled the herd and said, okay, who really are the good business people? Because when I was in software back in right before Y2K, you know, I joke with people that any idiot with a telephone could make $100K in the software industry prior to Y2K. And so a lot of people came out of that thinking they were good sales reps when in fact they were just at the right place at the right time. A lot of business owners have found out the same thing, if they're still surviving in today's economy, that it was right place, right time. A great story I've got is a friend of mine's brother owned a wine cellar business up in Seattle, and, you know, putting wine cellars in upscale homes. And and it was a good growing business, completely leveraged. He bragged about putting it on credit cards. Him and his partner were in it. They had 20-something vehicles, 100-plus employees, numerous retail locations. And then one day the bank, because of all the problems in the banking industry, decides to call their line of credit. And within 6 months, his company's out of business. And the guy's beating himself up, you know, going from the point of, you know, he had a mountain house and he had the perfect 2.2 kids in the mountain house and everything was, you know, exactly as it's supposed to be when you're running a business like that, to the point where he was telling his brother that, I only keep a quarter tank of gas in my Suburban because I'm expecting my truck to get repoed any moment. So he went from very high to very low, and he was questioning, what did I do wrong? You know, what was, you know, where did I screw this thing up? And then as I was describing it, as the story was being told to me, it dawned on me that if you went back to 2005 or 2000 and you went to Entrepreneur Magazine or you went to any of the small business magazines, you would find numerous articles extolling the virtues of growing your business by leveraging debt. Use your credit cards. It was like, I don't know how many articles I read about, you know, people pounding their chests that I'm $100,000 in credit card debt growing my business. Well, the reality was he did exactly what people were told to do. Yeah, it was the success story.
It was the strategy of the day.
It was, and then the rules changed. And in 6 months, this guy was out of business because the rules changed.
As were a lot of people, because that was no longer a sustainable way of managing a company.
Or a country.
Good point. So speaking of which, I mean, what have you observed since the big meltdown of 2008? I mean, obviously, a lot of people experienced a couple of rough years. We're now a few years away from that. What are you seeing in the small business landscape? Have the people that survived managed to start building and growing and creating another boom for us, if you will?
Well, I wouldn't call it a boom. One of my strategies, coming into as I was watching the meltdown start to occur and looking at the number of businesses who were highly leveraged, people tended to live, you know, their house was too big or their car was too big and they were leveraged to the hilt. They ran their business the same way. So either they had high credit card, high credit lines, and so it was all leveraged, hoping that the gravy train would never stop. So my clients tend to have the same philosophies that I do about business, and you know, when they read the book, it really resonates with them. So I took a strategy of last man standing, which was, we know our competitors are going to be going out of business. So what can we do to make sure we're one of the last remaining people in that sector? Because every industry, with the exception of a few, maybe like gun manufacturers and ammo manufacturers, I was reading the other day that those are going through the roof. But every other business sector have seen competitors fall by the wayside. So we spent a lot of time re-architecting the business, getting better employees in, redesigning sales processes, redesigning the sales messaging to reflect today's economy, not 2005's economy. And we're seeing really good success. I mean, my clients are, you know, a couple of examples are, we're seeing 12-15% growth since 2009. And this particular company, when they hired me, was literally Friday they were going to close their doors. So, and they had high debt levels, and we had to go in and renegotiate the debt and do a lot of restructuring and get rid of some employees. But all of my clients have seen sales increases because we've changed our messaging. I've got one client who has a national account that is primarily where he sells all of his business. And he told me just this week that he's going to do 400% more this year than he did last year. And then we did probably 200% more than we did the year before that. All with positioning, all changing the wording, and just getting really smart about how we sell. It has nothing to do with social media strategies at this point. It has nothing to do with fancy, you know, advertising. It's all...
There's no gimmick.
There's no
oh, this
gimmick.
One thing will work for you.
No.
I guarantee.
It doesn't work that way.
It's customized. A strategy is going to depend on the business, on the market, on the time, on, you know, the people, the players.
Well, I note in the book that if you take a look at every business, small business, the business owner is different. Their employees are different. Their geographic location is different. Their competitors are different. Who they sell to and how they sell is different. Their personal finances, you know, how deep pockets do they have to be able to fund their business is different. Everything is different in that sense. So to come in and say, here's a cookie cutter business strategy, then I'm going to fix your business and take it to the next level. Well, it doesn't work because there's so many variables. Now, there are some truisms in sales that says here are some things that you should be doing, but when you implement them, is determined entirely by where that business owner is psychologically. Are they ready for change?
Now, one of the recommendations you make in the book is for business owners to take a personality mm-hmm. assessment test or some form of measurement. Of, you know, who what is their innate personality makeup?
Right.
Why is that such an important piece of the puzzle or a way to solve the puzzle?
Well, it's more to me, it's getting that person to know who they are, because as a small business owner, you know, your mood dictates what happens in the office place. You know, if you're the type of business owner manager that the employees watch to see how you react when you come in the morning. And if you close your door, you know, everybody knows, oh, God, it's going to be a horrible day because, you know, they've closed their door. So the other thing, too, is, excuse me, it is your management style is determined by your personality type. And so, for example, in a lot of the assessments we use are DISC-based, D-I-S-C, and a person who has a high D component, I have a very high D component, I'm very outspoken, I'm to the point. One of the things I had to learn in my management career was to put the humanity into question, you know. So I'd go to my employees and I'd say, you know, hey, can you get this for me, do this for me, thanks, and I'd leave. And that person who's probably had a high I component of this profile would be like, well, he didn't say hi, he didn't say how my morning is, he didn't ask me how I'm doing. And as a high D, which a lot of entrepreneurs are, We only about 10% of the population are, I think, roughly make up the Ds. We have to remember to put some humanity in how we communicate with people. Accordingly, you see some business owners who are high I's, and they'll hire people because they like them, not because that person's good for their company. And then they'll make a bad hire, and then they can't fire them because they don't want to, they want to offend the person, you know, they made a friend with them, et cetera. You get people who are high S's, And there are some business owners out there who IS is they don't like change. They like things to go very smoothly. They don't like the boat to be rocked. And in today's world of small business, that's just a luxury that doesn't exist. And the last component is a C component, which is the detailed-oriented person. And oftentimes, C-level people, I mean, C-component people require too much detail to make decisions. And there's not a right or a wrong way. It's just the ability to understand this is who I am and how I communicate. So I, for example, don't need a lot of detail to make decisions, whereas a C person does. And that directly impacts how you manage your business on a day-to-day basis.
Well, nowadays, with the rate of change increasing so much, I think that being decisive and being able to make decisions on limited information has always been an important component
Absolutely.
Of being a leader. But it seems that it's even more so today. And contrasting to the need to make decisions even more quickly and probably with more variables in the unknown, we also have a world where information is ubiquitous. So I could spend an infinite amount of hours researching said issue, problem, decision
Absolutely.
On the internet, right? But meanwhile, the climate of today is forcing me to resist that urge and react and decide something in a much more timely manner. Is that something that you see your clients struggling with?
Well, I struggle with it. Great example is I'm doing a lot of research into social media, trying to find a good B2B play. I see a lot of B2C plays that work, but a true business-to-business environment, especially in small business, I'm struggling to find something that really works. And so, you know, for example, in my world, this just tells you how complicated it is. You know, I've got a Twitter account. I've got two Facebook pages, you know, one for my book, one for me. I've got three websites. I've got a blog. What
it's
else have
ridiculous.
I got?
Ridiculous.
It is. It's getting insane. And then when you go out and you read what you're supposed to do in social media, that's just a full-time job blogging and tweeting. And then as I'm trying to figure all this stuff out, I read an article yesterday in Forbes where this guy's saying that there's a good chance that Google and Facebook, as we know it, will be gone in 5 years because of the speed of change in the industry. So you went from Web 1.0, which is Google, or Yahoo and those types of companies, the Web 2.0, which is Google and Facebook, and now everything's going mobile. And so there's speculation out there that, you know, what's Google's business plan looks like? Because when you think about now, if you're going to go out to a restaurant or if you're going to go out someplace, chances are you got an app on your iPhone that's going to give you a review. So instead of Googling a restaurant, you're going to use Yelp, for example, to see what are the reviews like. So now you're taking it another step away from what you know, the Google business model of let's just do search. And so I'm like, oh, great. You know, I'm in the middle of trying to figure this stuff out, and now it's going to be gone in 5 years. And so now you figure downloaded a chapter to a book called The Citizen Influencer. And one of the problems I'm struggling with in the social media is kind of the benefit from the effort. And
right, the bang for the buck.
Yeah.
Because, as you said, there's a lot of work involved, and we're now maintaining a lot of different accounts and profiles and social circles in the web space.
Yeah.
So where do I get my return? Because, you know, if there's other things I could be doing that are better use of my time.
You know, so everybody's out there chasing the, you know, the ubiquitous like. And, you know, so that's a measure of success. Well, how many likes do I need to get turned into a dollar? And I was reading this book, one of the chapters is called Citizen Influencer, and it was talking a program out there called Clout that goes out and searches the web and finds people who are highly connected, meaning this one particular guy who was a web designer for the city of L.A., he's got 80,000 Twitter followers, and he tweets 200 times a day. And, you know, I'd hate to be his employer because, you know, he's not getting any work done.
Right.
200 times a day.
It sounds like he doesn't eat or sleep or have friends that exist in the flesh either.
Yeah, in his world, he's found his identity through tweeting, and he's got 80,000 followers. And the story was talking about Virgin Airlines, who was opening a new route to Toronto. So they went using Clout and found 120 people who are highly connected, and he was one of them. So they gave him a free plane ticket. So from the 120 people that he had, or 120 people that they gave free tickets to, they wound up getting like 7.4 million impressions and just across the web and tweets and blog, you know, it was considered very successful.
Right.
But they interviewed this guy who has the 80,000 followers, and his success was that he, you know, companies come to him, and Audi gave him an A8 to drive for a week, and somebody else gave him some coupons, and some, you know, it was this ridiculous, it's like you do 200 tweets a day.
Right. Now he's got a lot of pull with all these people.
But it doesn't do anything, though. He's not making any money on it. It's ridiculous. And then there was another woman that...
So it's become more of a social media addiction, affliction, than it has a productive...
And here's a perfect example. Subway gave another woman a $10 coupon. And she's so excited that she was given this $10 coupon for this sandwich that she immediately tweets that she was awarded the sandwich because of her political clout or her Twitter clout. And then she takes pictures of it when she gets there and tweets it and tweets the whole experience about getting a free $10 sandwich at Subway. And I was like, really? Is that what it's come down to? You know, it's like you're, all this work for a $10 coupon at Subway?
You know, you're willing to prostitute yourself for a $10 coupon at Subway. Well, every little bit helps. The girl's got to eat.
Well, but it's – I'm struggling to find and there's so many experts out there that tell you this is what you should do and this is where you should go and the conflicting information. And part of the reason I wrote the book was not only in social media but just in business in general, there's so many conflicting messages out there.
Now, there's that new law that's being proposed in New York. A congressman has proposed that new legislation around employers demanding Facebook passwords. And this is sort of bringing it to a head. I mean, how do these personal social media behaviors that have now become part of everyone's life, how do they interface with the business reality? Whether you're an entrepreneur or an employee, is that different?
Well, this is part of where things are changing so fast that we're in a very historic point because there's no precedent for this. You know, when you think about you see people on Facebook blistering their company or their manager on Facebook.
Just had the worst day at my job at XYZ Corporation.
And, you know, your first thought is, I wonder if this manager reads that. But then the second thought is, that person is now negatively impacting the brand of the company he works for or he or she works for. Am I a proponent of giving Facebook? No, absolutely not. Of giving I think that's invasion of privacy. And to argue the other side of the coin, if you have an employee out there, and you just saw it recently, Fox News, where they fired somebody who was being a mole inside and giving information to a left-wing website. Yeah, there's...
Right. At which point do you cross a line where you're now sabotaging the business strategy?
Right.
It's one thing if you're just doing your own personal thing and keeping your work and business life separate. But once you start to overlap that with what you're talking about,
but it's
tough because I'm a huge privacy advocate. And I think that we don't want to over legislate these things and get the government to
but you saw what Google just admitted to, though, that, you know, they have programs and there are some of their employees didn't know they were doing it where they're. You know,
oh, they're tracking everything.
Everything. Passwords, everything.
And then every Google search that's been made for, I mean, really, they say only the last 5 years they save. But I think that just means they've archived the other stuff.
Yeah.
But literally, right. So if they're saving and have access to the data of every Google search that anyone has ever made, of course, they're going to be collecting all kinds of stuff.
All your personal information. And when you look at the difference between Google advertising and Facebook advertising, I just read the other day that Facebook advertising is starting to plummet, and they're trying to figure out why. the thing that Google is envious of Facebook about is everybody that goes out on Facebook, you tell everybody in the world everything you want to, you know, they want to know about you. So it's like an advertiser's dream because they can get into some very specific demographic information and target to that. So Google was trying to do that behind the scenes, whereas Facebook will just tell you, you know,
this is how we make money.
This is how we do it.
We collect information about you and then we pitch you stuff that we think you might like. Right, so at least they're being upfront and honest about it. But do you anticipate, I mean, when we look at what's going to change over the next 5 to 10 years, because, I mean, your whole book is about change and the fact that the pace of change is so rapid and that to be successful as a business owner, you have to be nimble and flexible and able to change, which is something that most humans don't really care for.
They hate it.
Do you think there's going to be a big backlash from, I mean, social media today is so much about creating a public persona, being out there, being the person that tweets the most. Do you think that we're going to revert back to really clinging to our privacy once we realize how valuable it is?
I don't think so, because I think it's a generational thing.
It's forever changed with Gen Y.
Yeah. And like my son's 14 and I'll send him an email about something, or his grandmother will send him an email. And he never reads his email because email's old school. You know, it's all texting. And, you know, my friend of mine was
mailing someone a letter.
Yeah, a friend of mine was telling me that his son averages 5,000 texts a month. And he came close to 10,000 one month, so he made it his goal to see if he can hit 10,000. Kids communicate completely different. And you can start seeing it now with Gen Y coming into the businesses where you look at business letters, you look at emails, and the art of communication is really suffering for it, you know, because there just isn't the proper grammar and business etiquette because they're so used to everything just being right out there and communicating and expecting things to happen now. I also think it's creating a very narcissistic generation because it's all about them.
Well, you talk about Gen Y in your book and about them as employees, and when you're at the point as a business that you're looking to hire people, realizing that when you hire that person, you're not just hiring them for the work that they're going to do at your company every day. You're hiring the entire person, which means their personal life, you know, if they've got any psychological issues, their personality, their good days, their bad days, their relationship with their spouse, you're hiring all of that into your company. And that Gen Y operates very differently or from a very different mindset than previous generations.
Well, you look at the percentage of these kids that are living at home with their parents still in their 20s and sometimes into their 30s. It's a very high number. And you look at the number of the kids graduating college now, 53% of them, that last statistic I saw, you know, are either unemployed or underemployed. And so there's a whole – they're coming into a world in which they saw their parents, you know, working really hard all their lives for their pension or whatever they were working for, the 401k and, you know, the American dream of their house, et cetera, et cetera. And now suddenly they're seeing their parents don't have jobs, or they're seeing their 401ks are gone, or whatever, you know, they're foreclosed on. Everybody knows somebody who's lost a home now or is worried about a home. Everybody knows somebody out of work, professionals who are out of work. And so these kids are growing up in an environment now where they're going, really, was it worth it?
And, right. And so that's really a good choice, a good path to follow. And why would I follow a similar path?
Why would I do that? You know, watch my mother work her butt off and try to raise her family only to get fired, you know, when she hits 50. And then what? And so these kids are bringing, and I can understand that too. I mean, they're bringing a different perspective into the workplace that says, and this goes back to personality styles of the business owner, I'm working 40 hours max. If I get 40 hours, I'm punching the clock. And the business owner's working 80 wondering, well, why don't you want to work for, you know, 80 like me? Well, one, it's not their business, and two, they don't care. And so when you're out hiring now, I mean, there are good young people out there with good work ethics, but – a lot of my daughter works and lives in D.C., and she's got two friends up there who have full-time jobs on the Hill, and both they're not internships, they're full-paying jobs, and both of their parents still pay for everything, even though they both have full-time jobs.
I know people like that.
I don't get that. Yeah. I don't get that.
It's new.
Yeah. And the parents are okay with it.
And the generation is a very forceful, having a very forceful impact, I think. And we're just at the beginning cusp of it. Because for, I think, when these people first started becoming, you know, on the workforce, we're like, oh, well, we're just not really going to take them all that seriously. But more and more companies have had to really figure out that this is a trend that's here to stay. These people are going to carry these kind of values with them throughout their lifetime. And we need to do something as a company to adapt to that, to make this a place where they will want to work.
Well, and compound that with the economy where you've got the boomer generations and with a very different work ethic are now staying in the workplace longer. And so you have now in the workplace, you sometimes have three different generations or more of work ethic in there, from the Gen Ys to the boomers, with very different perspectives, very different sets of expectations, and it causes conflict. And, you know, all of my clients, the number one thing they complain about is employees. It's just finding a good employee. The common question is, why did they do that? You know, it's just like, you know, I can't understand the psychology of doing that. And to the average employee, it's just like, because it's what I felt like doing. Doesn't make any sense. Deal with it. And you're just like, God. And so if you find a good employee these days, you want to bend over backwards to keep them, because even in this, with the unemployment the way it is, it's still hard to find good employees.
Right. Well, this brings up another thing you say in your book, that is, all people are not created equal.
No, they're not. It absolutely is not true. Some people are smarter, some are prettier, some are more athletic. You know, everybody's created different. And if you look at the average entrepreneur, for example, entrepreneurs, I joke with all my clients who are entrepreneurs, is we're all freaks. We're different than the person who likes to live in a cube or...
Right. It's very much a rogue career path. You're
absolutely
out of the ordinary. You didn't fit in with the way society tried to, you know, bring everybody up to work in a cubicle.
Yeah.
Go to work, drive to the office every day, that kind of thing. So, yeah, you're operating kind of outside of the mainstream.
And you have to have a high risk tolerance. You have to, you know, have to be able to, you know, get your teeth kicked in and get back up and keep doing it again. And a lot of people aren't cut out for that. And I think back prior to the meltdown, the economic meltdown, a lot of business owners could stay in business just because there was enough business coming in. But now what we're seeing, kind of circling back to what you're asking earlier, you can't fake it anymore in business. You know, you have to run your business. You have to know what you're doing in sales. You have to know your numbers. You have to know your cost. And, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, cash flowing to business anymore, because, you know, part of what the trends I'm seeing in not only small business but large business is credit lines are really hard to come by. And if you start paying off your credit line, the banks start canceling your credit lines or shrinking it. So, and then if you were used to funding your business on credit, like credit cards, that's gone. And now you have credit card interest rates in the 20s, and, you know, you can't afford that type of an interest rate. And so,
right, unless your profit margins are in the 40s.
Well, but there isn't a business that can afford a 20% plus credit, you know, interest rate. So so what's happened is businesses are having to learn how to manage the business without using credit to do it, especially small business. You know, the bigger guys like Apple and Google, you know, they're sitting on billions of dollars so in cash. So that's not an issue for them. But for the small business, cash is king right now. It is, because credit is hard or non-existent to come by.
So I was asked a question. I recently did an interview with Marie Claire in Malaysia, the women's magazine. And they were asking me, from a female entrepreneur perspective, about what's the best way to fund your small business. And I said through sales, mm-hmm. because when you go into debt, there's so many additional challenges that you take on. One, you're paying for it, so you've put yourself in a tight cash flow situation. And two, if you take on an investor or some kind of a partner, then you've got to adhere to all their expectations, right? Yeah. Suddenly the business is not really your own anymore.
I think
what are your thoughts on financing, growth, and how to get access to capital, and the pros and cons of the different ways to do it?
I think the classic example of how it can turn around and bite you is home builders. And you saw so many home builders go out of business because the business model was somewhat of a Ponzi scheme. They were always using the receipts from their last house to build the next house. And so as long as they could keep buying, they're always sitting on debt. They're always servicing the debt. And it was just hopefully that somebody wouldn't call the debt one day. And what happened was the banks started calling the debt in and people stopped buying houses, and they didn't have anything to pay for the next house because it was just a continual cash flow flush. All of my clients, what I'm doing with every single one of them was weaning them off of credit, is learning to run your business through cash, through cash flow, through sales, looking at your job cost, and not expecting that there's some magic bucket that you can go get money out. I've got a client that the next client that he's having problems right now. His business in itself is profitable, but what's killing him is debt service from mistakes he's made over the past couple of years. So the business itself is fine. He's got cash flow problems because he's servicing old debt, that some decisions he made during the good old days. And so what my business model is, even when I'm looking at doing an advertising campaign or doing some type of marketing campaign, is what is the least expensive way or free way that we can go out and get the message out without going out and spending money? Because even in marketing today, what works? You know, you look at the traditional marketing methods and
right.
What works?
An ad in the phone book?
Yeah, you know, or telemarketing, you know, and you know.
Right, a billboard. All, like, so many of the classics that people used, I mean, a lot of industries were, it was the standard,
yeah.
Even. A lot of that is starting to shift.
Absolutely.
They keep dropping that phone book off for me, and I just put it right in the recycling bin, because why would I bring it into my house?
Yeah.
I'm never going to look in the phone book for information.
But that's a generational thing, too. You know, my daughter,
right.
My daughter never will. My mother-in-law does, and it even goes to newspapers. You know, my generation, I love the tactile feel on Sunday morning, sitting down and reading the Sunday newspaper while I eat breakfast with my wife. My daughter never reads a newspaper, you know, and she never will. She gets all her information on her iPad. And so you're seeing newspaper revenues plummet because that medium's changing. And it all goes back to that generational warfare between, you know, the boomers and the Ys, and,
right.
You know, how people get information and how.
It's all shifting to internet radio.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is where you're all getting your information.
It is where people are getting their information, because I sit down every morning and, I used to have a subscription to the Wall Street Journal. I don't pay for the paper anymore, you know, and I get my information from every morning. I read five or six websites and I don't pay for it.
Exactly. Now, I did read an article that they're going to start an all-news radio station here in Atlanta, similar to like a WSB in mm-hmm. Chicago, or, you know, a lot of big cities have an all-news talk radio station as kind of a staple in their local market. And we don't have anything like that here in Atlanta. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, I think what's happening is, like, you look at TV, for example, and what internet – Your medium does it differently. We're getting, we have Dish Satellite, and they've got some new thing called a hopper out where you can record six programs at one time. And my understanding of it is during prime time, they will actually store a week's worth of something of programming, I guess it's over a certain channel, that if I want to go back and watch something, I don't even have to record it. I can go back and find it and record it.
It's just really on demand, on your fingertips. All this huge library.
Yeah. And it's like listening to your favorite radio show or watching your favorite TV program. Like on TV, because of DVRs, you know, if I have to sit through commercials because I haven't DVR'd something, I'm getting really antsy. So it fundamentally changes the way you expect information to be delivered to you. And, you know, the problem with traditional radio shows is if I've got a talk radio person I like to listen to, but I'm not around a radio at that particular time, I don't hear it.
Right.
And
right.
I can't go back and listen to it. And, you know, they're offering premium programs that you can program in. You can do that too. But all of that, that even goes back to marketing now. In with small business, people go, well, should I market on TV? Well, I don't know. Are you watching the commercials? Well, no, I'm not. So what makes you think I'm going to see yours?
But anybody else is, yeah. if it's not part of your behavior.
And if you start watching TV shows closely, you'll see that the major, like, automobile manufacturers are doing a lot of product placement, and especially the car dealers or the car companies. And, you know, they'll just blatantly put something in the show that has nothing to do with the show, but it's like, hey, let's talk to the, you know, the computer on board, and you can see how cool this is. It's like, God, that is, they're not even hiding it anymore.
Right. <Yeah. laughs> Let's go out and have a Coca-Cola yeah. and think about this big decision you have to make.
Exactly.
Just throwing it right in there. Right. So our business and our lives are becoming even more commingled these days. How do entrepreneurs cope with this? Do they just embrace that that's the way it is now? There's not a delineating line between who you are as a person and what you do for work?
I've got a section in my book about that, and I'm not a proponent of you can have it all. You know, if you look at...
See, another controversial point of view here. You're just shooting down all of the things that we've heard over and over again that's become kind of like, you know, just urban legends that people hear about and yeah. believe. But so you can't have it all, Kevin.
You look at divorce rates. You look at what are the most prescribed drugs in the United States, and we are like one of the most heavily drugged cultures in the history of the world, and it's antidepressants and you know, things to do with heart disease and high, you know, high blood pressure.
So even if you think you have it all, you're just deluding yourself.
Probably, you know, because it, you know, it's. I remember when I was growing up in the 70s. You know, it was, you know, women can have it all. You have a full time career, be a full time mom, and it, no, you can't. There's just not enough time. Something's got to give, and you know, the whole quality time versus quantity time. You know, that type of. It's just rationalization that says, you know, yeah, there's only 24 hours in a day, and I got to sleep, and I got to work, and then I got to raise my kids. You know, something's got to give someplace. And you'll see it with business owners. These guys working, you know, 100 hours. There's no time for anything else in your life. There's no time for wives. There's no time for kids. You know, there just isn't. And you're kidding yourself if you think there is. And I think it's one of the big... disservices that have been done out there is to make people think that there's actually is a way that you can, you know, work 20 hours a day, raising a family, working, et cetera, et cetera. You can't. Well, if you want to, you know, medicate yourself, probably you can. And then that's what we're doing as a culture.
So resetting our expectations to what's realistic and what's possible.
Well, I think the economy is going to do it for us anyway. You know, we're coming out of a worldwide debt-fueled experiment in growth, and it was all debt-fueled. You know, it wasn't organically sales-grown. It wasn't anything other than free money, free credit. And, you know, if you want to go on a vacation, right. You don't have the money, well, let's go pull $10,000 out of our house.
So it was prosperity by illusion.
Yeah, and it's like the story I was telling you about the guy in Seattle. He was doing exactly what everybody told you to do. And now what's happening, I think, is people are having to, you know, my daughter's getting married and lives in D.C., and they're going to get rid of one car, you know, just because they live in D.C., they don't need two cars. Well, that's a radical change for somebody raised in suburbia. And I think the economy is forcing people to kind of set back and reevaluate some of the material things and some of the, you know, do I really need, you know, the granite countertops, you know, it's kind of, there's a great website I saw that was so 2005. And so it was the race to keep up with the Joneses, the bigger car, the bigger house. And now everybody's figuring out that, oh, this maybe it's not sustainable for most people. And so I think the economy in the world is going to start resetting people's expectations. And you're seeing it happening in Europe right now. I don't, if you've seen the unemployment rates in Spain, for example, it's 25%. And I think for the 18 to 25 year old range, the unemployment's 50%.
It's pretty scary.
Yeah.
To see what's going on over there. It's not quite at that point here in the U.S., but I certainly hear when I talk to people that are getting ready to graduate college concern over whether or not there's really jobs out there for them, and you know, them contemplating just staying in school. Maybe I'll get a master's, maybe I'll get a PhD.
Yeah, it's why?
Like, that's not really.
And then they come out so much in debt, and you think about these kids coming out of college with $100,000 in debt. You think they're going to buy a home?
Right. Or be able to add fuel to the economic
No, they got to service that $100,000 debt. And then, you know, banks now are so tight in their lending, they're not going to loan somebody coming out of the, you know, the ninja loans of old are gone. So
which path do you think is better to take at this point? I mean, obviously it's going to depend on the individual. But if somebody's looking at maybe they just got laid off of their job and saying, you know, should I polish up that resume and start looking for another job? Should I look into this idea of starting my own business? Which path is going to reap better rewards? Because you see companies like, you know, there's a lot of good economic news in, you know, in Atlanta today. Coca-Cola is talking about doing a stock split. I mean, mm-hmm. they've clearly got some good cash. Delta is considering buying U.S. Airways. So there are big companies that are flourishing now.
Well, I wouldn't say Delta's flourishing. It's one poorly run company buying a even more poorly run company. You know, and their balance sheets look horrible. Coke's a different story. You know, but
if you look at, you know, where do I want to spend my time? Do I want to jump on board one of these big companies? Try and build a career in that landscape, or start my own venture?
Well, that's a really tough question, because I've got a couple of friends of mine who are out of business, out of work. And, you know, that's a fundamental question. Do you want to start your own business, or do you find another job? And as I mentioned earlier, starting your own business is not for everybody. Even to the point of if you work for a company and working from home, you know, that's not for everybody either. And, you know, it takes a certain amount of discipline to be able to, you know, not watch Oprah while you're working from home and doing your laundry when you should be working. Some people need to be in an office environment. It's totally up to the individual. It's getting harder and harder to find jobs in corporate America, so some people are being forced to do that. I think the good news is there's some people who are entrepreneurial-minded but never had the incentive or the courage to jump out and do it on their own, and nature's kind of forced them to do it. And so you're going to see some of these people succeeding because they've got the skill set. Other people should absolutely not go into business for themselves. They're just not wired to do it. And, it, you know, it's not a right or wrong question. It's really how you're wired. And do you have the skill set? Do you have the courage? Do you have the ability to not make money for the next 2 years as you're building a business?
So, Kevin, what's the big takeaway from your book? And, you know, why should people go out and get themselves a copy? What's going to help them do?
Well, it cuts through the hype that so many business books are out there. And, you know, one of the most famous books for small business is The E-Myth. And, you know, The E-Myth is a great book, but my problem with The E-Myth is it basically says you build the processes and your business will succeed. And, well, it discounts the fact you need customers and sales in order for your business to grow. And I don't care how good your processes are. If you're not selling anything, it doesn't matter. But one of the books that was the genesis for me writing this book was this the book called The Secret. And brilliant, fantastic marketing. And it basically says, you know, your thoughts are things, and your thoughts are down at the quantitative physics level. And so you just need to imagine customers, and customers will...
They will appear.
It doesn't work that way. I was sitting in a meeting years ago, and with a bunch of business coaches, and the speaker said, what we all need to do is go out and buy a bigger car, because the void that creates in our cash flow will be filled by customers, because nature hates a vacuum. And there are people just eating it up. And I'm just sitting in the back of the room going, really? You know, you're believing that? And all the book does is just bring common sense. Here's some reality. Here's common sense. There's no magic bullet. There's no magic set of steps. It says, here's the 10 steps to make your business run. It's common sense. It's hard work. It's luck. And it's getting out of your own way. It's being a good leader and recognizing, I don't know the answer to that. Maybe I need to go find the answer from somebody else. Or, well, I messed that up. Or sometimes it's just surrounding yourself with the people that says, yeah, that is a good idea. That takes courage. Go for it. When everybody else around you is telling you it's a bad idea.
So where can people go to find out more about your book and hire you as a business consultant?
You can go out to Change or Go Broke. You can find, if you Google that, you'll find my blog. You'll find the book. I prefer that you buy it on my website, but you can buy it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It is an ebook. You can go out to quadrantgroup.biz or kevinhanville.com and find out about my consulting, public speaking, and all that stuff. So just Google Kevin Hanville and you'll find out all kinds of stuff.
Well, thanks, Kevin Hanville, for coming on. It's been a pleasure getting to know you, and we appreciate having you a guest on Good Morning Atlanta.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This is Elizabeth Gordon, and up next we've got Southern Hospitality. I have two fantastic guests for you that are going to talk about two of the best places to experience Southern Hospitality here in downtown Atlanta. Marty Morris with Hyatt Place and Alan LeBlanc with Max Loggers. So stay tuned. We will be coming up with our next show shortly. Have a great day.